This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be here till 2 p.m. This afternoon, I'm going to feature two local authors, in some ways primarily historians, but ones who go at their trade from very different angles and who cover very different aspects of Nevada County life. The first is Hank Meals, a archaeologist, photographer, historian. He's looking at me kind of blankly. I don't know what to call him. Welcome back to Booktown.
Thank you.
How do you think of yourself primarily now?
Well, I'm just a Nevada County traditionalist. I'm getting by doing a little of this and a little of that.
And you've been here since about 69?
Yeah, that's when I first came here. Yeah.
At which point in your new book, The River, you describe yourself as a hippie, or?
There's no getting around it. A hippie then, post-hippie now, hopefully.
Okay. Over the years, Hank has done a lot of archaeological work and historical work for the Forest Service. I guess you were mostly a contract employee?
Yeah.
And then has written numerous pieces about the area, some things for the Historical Society, but mostly books.
Yeah, mostly books.
It started out with Yuba Trails. The first one came out in the 80s or 90s?
Yeah, it did. The first one was basically my wife at the time, Susan Lamella. We would go out on hikes and come back completely stoked and tell our friends, and they'd say, well, you ought to write this down. And the first idea was, well, maybe we should do something on KVMR about this. And eventually we did give to our friends a spiral-bound copy of Xerox Trails with a little bit of history and some maps. And we started getting calls from Sacramento and other places. People had seen it, and they wanted copies of it. And we started, we had it in Eric's bookstore at the time, Grimblefinger, I think, and also in Grass Valley Map and Blueprint were our two outlets.
Uh-huh. And then that went on to an actual bound Yuba Trails, the first gray edition, and then Yuba Trails 2, which is the green and yellow one,
yeah,
which is still available.
It is not. It's out of print. Oh. And so when it went out of print, I was faced with, well, should I update this again? But I felt that it had, a lot of people know this, but my wife Susan died during the writing of the second one. And so much of the second book was an elegy to her that I didn't feel it made sense to do that again. So I wrote a brand new book.
And this one is called The River. It's
right.
Based on the idea, I think, that at least in Northern California 50 years ago, if you said, I'm going to the city, everyone knew what you meant. If you said, I'm going to the lake, everyone knew what you meant. And around here, if you go to the river, there's no question what river you have in mind.
That's right.
I was thinking that because of that, maybe we should just call this The Book.
The Book.
And everyone will know it's the book about the river. Anyway, it's a fascinating book, and I found, much as I liked Yuba Trails and Yuba Trails 2, I do occasionally enjoy going to the high country, but I'm a person who likes to walk where I am rather than get in a car to go for a walk. And I would say that probably only about a third of Yuba Trails 2 did I ever use, whereas almost everything in the river, although it's brand new and I've just been reading it in the last week, I'm very familiar with everything. And I've been to most of the places, and a couple of the ones I haven't, I might even get in a car to go to. it's entirely the South Yuba. I guess, you know, there might be somebody at a distance, somebody who's picking us up in the Philippines or Uganda might not know that the river is the South Fork of the Yuba River.
Right. This one, I got a lot of feedback on the first two books, and one of the things I found that the trails I was including were simply the trails I liked. My book, I'm going to do it my way. But in this one, I felt like I should really be comprehensive and include all the trails on the South Fork of the Yuba because my friends are aging, I'm aging, people want to walk with their relatives when they come up here. So I've included trails that are interpretive and easy to do because they have things to offer as well. So this one's much more comprehensive.
Things like Independence Trail and the Rock Creek Nature
right.
Study Trail and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And you do have a number that are in the watershed but not directly connected, like all the trails around North Bloomfield.
Right. Well, that's Humbug Creek is a tributary of the South Fork.
Right. And you can get to all of them from the South Fork. There are trails that connect them.
Well, part of the underlying theme of this is to tune you into what is the South Fork of the Yuba? How extensive a system is it? Actually, if you start walking in the winter, if you start down at the mouth of it at Bridgeport, and you walked your way up, that's the way the book's laid out, you'll know a hell of a lot about the South Yuba.
Right. And it starts with Bridgeport, basically, and with Defiance Point, which are places that thousands of people throng to every summer.
But, you should go to these that summer, but we're so fortunate because many of these trails, at least up as far as Washington, are accessible all year. And I really encourage people to walk in the off-season. For one thing, the deciduous plants lose their leaves and you have better visibility. You don't have snakes, if that's a fear of yours. And you can hear the river from many more places because there's more water in the river.
Mm-hmm. I also was very pleased by the way you've changed the arrangement of the book. In Yuba Trails, all the history comes at the beginning. And it's if you wanted to get a history of the Yuba watershed, that's more compact and you can get it all in one place. But here you intersperse the history with each specific locale. And I found it much more interesting to read than if I was just... Especially if I was going to read a description, now you go around this corner and you will see such and such. If I could remember what it was I was going to see, it would trigger. But if it was something I'd never seen, it wouldn't. But knowing the historical associations gave me much more interest in places that I've never been to.
Yeah, this one is place-based. I based it on places where you can get access to the South Fork of the river or Grouse Ridge, which is on Canyon Creek, which is part a tributary again of the South Fork. But you'd start off, if you're going to a particular area like Bowman Road, you'll get a large ration of history, and then and then the trails, and then some of the trails have a very distinctive history as well.
And there are places that were much more prominent at some times, like all of the mines or hydraulic sites around Washington.
Yeah.
And then Meadow Lake, which was a boomtown for a while.
Yeah, Meadow Lake is a fascinating story, and I've read many versions of it, and a lot of them are written by reporters in the 40s, post-World War II, and that they've been quoted, and so it got a little over-the-top romantic, although it is romantic anyway. But I've tried to tell the story again, with plenty of facts in it and the entertainment value.
And the other thing that ties in as you move up the river is you hear about all the different, the hydraulic mining companies and then the various water companies that took over after the hydraulic mining was outlawed.
I want people to have a sense of that, of what, how much, of where the water's going, essentially. I mean, we're talking about a watershed and... where does all that water go? Above Spalding, it's a completely different story because after the end of hydraulic mining, which is about 1884, you still have this terrific infrastructure of dams and ditches and flumes that are deteriorating and were picked up by the next big technological wave of hydroelectricity and irrigation. So I think most people aren't aware of how intricate that system is. So I touch on it, I hope, in a way that's accessible, because it's a very complicated topic. And so I've pared it down, but I hope it's understandable where the water's going.
And some of the facts about Nevada County, which people may have heard thrown out at various times, like that the first long-distance telephone line mm-hmm. in the country was in Nevada County.
Yeah.
I never knew exactly what purpose it served, but you explain it.
Mm-hmm. It has to do, it's part of the efficient functioning of a water conveyance system. I mean, obviously, it makes more sense if something, if part of a ditch blows out, if you can call the dam tender to shut off the water. This is a great feature.
So this 60-mile line was the first long-distance line in the country.
Well, there are a lot of firsts here. I mean, one of the really remarkable things about Nevada County is the inventiveness. It's built into mining history, and I certainly don't glorify mining history in here because I think it was a poor trade-off. But still, what the positive things that have come from that are these wonderful kinds of insight-type inventions, like something as simple as a Pelton wheel, where it, by putting a split in the bucket, you increase the efficiency and velocity of that. Very simple. Hydraulic mining, just pointing an existing technology, technology that was on fire trucks at the time, at a bank to break down the old gravel deposits. I mean, there are lots of inventions like that that happened in Nevada County.
Nonetheless, you do describe it as the greatest ecological disaster that ever occurred in California.
Pretty much around here, yes.
Another interesting point that many people may have heard was that PG&E essentially started from the combination of several Nevada County companies.
Yes.
And that's something you describe in some detail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, unfortunately, there's some places where there's private property and you can't go to the exact location of, say, the Rome Powerhouse. But I address it as I talk about that piece of river. And I try to connect all these things so that when you're finished with the book, you have some understanding and you have some sense of the inventions, the good things and the bad things that came out of our history.
And what came out of hydraulic mining was hydroelectric power and irrigation, so that means really PG&E and NID, and it turns out that their interaction was much more complex than some people might know.
Yeah. Well, on the downside of hydraulic mining, we are still dealing with quicksilver or mercury. It's systemic. Right now, there's some studies going on, BLM and I think USGS below Humbug Creek when it comes into the South Yuba. Below that, they're trying to do some real science.
This is cleanup that is entirely fallen upon the government. That means upon the people, since the companies that did the destructiveness are no longer around.
Well, this is the story of mining over and over again, is promises. And despite even later when mining on public land, people put up bonds to offset any damage they might cause, but the bonds have always been insufficient, and mines come and go. And when it's time to collect or remediate or repair what's been done, there's nobody to talk to.
I'm going to ask you to come out on a limb for a minute on this. The Idaho, Maryland, the company that now owns the Idaho, Maryland mine is talking about reopening it. One of their officials recently ran an op-ed piece in the Union rebutting the claims that this would be a disaster and saying that, well, this time we'll do it right. We'll clean up all the messes from before. Do you believe them?
I've heard this story before. I don't. You can get on the internet and look at any mine, and if you look at it through time, there are a lot of Canadian companies, and I think this is one, who are mining all over the world, and it's the same old story. Their promises. I don't think we know what we're in for, frankly, but let me tell you, mining is heavy, heavy industry, and I don't think it belongs in a city. There are a lot of ancillary impacts that I think we can't even see right now.
And at one point, I can't remember the exact numbers, but I think you specify that at the peak of the hydraulic mining, it took something like 500,000 gallons of water to produce a dollar's worth of gold.
Right. Yeah. Every day at Malakoff, they used more water than the city of San Francisco to mine.
And these days, the technology is to extract even smaller amounts of gold from huger amounts of ore by more advanced techniques, which use even more water and leave behind even more debris.
Well, the essential difference between Malakoff, which was a big placer mine, basically, where you have free gold and it can be trapped in sluices and it can be seen for the most part. There is some smaller gold too, versus a hard rock mine where the gold isn't even visible to the naked eye. So to access that gold, you're going to have to introduce some chemistry at some point, and it all goes downstream. It's that simple.
And the three basic chemicals that were used were mercury, arsenic, and later on cyanide.
Right, cyanide. Now, they didn't introduce arsenic. Arsenic is a background mineral.
Oh, excuse me.
That's in the ore. It's the amount of ore that you're bringing out, which is much more than would have weathered naturally, and it's left outside to be rained on. It creates a concentration of arsenic. So you get acid mine drainage out of that.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'm talking with local historian, photographer, and many other things, Hank Meals, about his new book, The River, Hiking Trails and History of the South Fork of the Yuba River. In the second half of the program, we're going to talk with another local historian, Orville Bronson, about his book, Launched into Eternity, Lynchings and Judicial Executions. In 19th century Nevada County, and I hope to have the two of them talk together a little about their techniques, their views of history, in the second half of the program. Another theme as you move up the river, in the river, is the various battles that the South Yuba River Citizens League has fought, and those occurred pretty far down the river, because the first threatened dam that brought Circle into being was quite far down the Yuba. Since then, there have been other threats farther up.
Well, when you're down at the 49 crossing of the Yuba now, you've got Circle to thank for what we have down there, because there were plans to put a dam just upstream from there, and that would have been ultimately part of a series of dams, and this area would be completely different if those had gone through. The beautiful thing about Circle, it was very grassroots. It was based on people's places where they went for swimming and spiritual renewal and sheer pleasure. And this really hit home with us.
So these are the people in Circle are probably people that you've met again and again.
That's
on
right.
Different parts of the river.
And now Circle's a set of completely different personalities, but still keenly focused, much more efficient, much bigger organization. It's really something to be proud of.
It never succeeded in getting federal wild and scenic status for the South Yuba, but it did get state wild and scenic
status. It did. And I think it's an ongoing fight, any way you look at it. Now we're talking about drought, and every once in a while you hear the murmurs about dams again. But now that we're mobilized and focused, it's going to be a lot harder on that level, too.
Right. Nonetheless, in your section on Spalding, Lake Spalding, you quote a writer for the PG&E magazine in 1913. He's describing the Spalding Dam as a huge monolithic structure that made the little trickling stream below that stands for the South Yuba at the present time look puny indeed. But then you comment that this is what Circle succeeded in getting named wild and scenic.
Yeah. Well, that battle goes on. I mean, there are increased demands. I don't have the figure, but it's just a piddling amount that's allowed to stay in the South Yuba Canyon above Spalding. The next major contributing stream is Canyon Creek, which is about 5 miles above, or 3 miles above Washington. We have to be responsible all around. Right now, the FERC, the federal relicensing of the dams, is coming. Those hearings are beginning again, and they only do that about once every 40 or 50 years. And when they did it the last time, they didn't consider the species of plants and animals that are below, and this time they'll have to.
Which dams are coming up for review?
Well, just about all of the higher ones, but not Engelbreit. So Bowman, Spalding would be the main ones that we're concerned about.
And what's going to happen in these hearings?
Well, there's going to be lots of input from environmental people, but there'll also be a lot of input and vision from people who want to manage this water for hydroelectricity in Placer County. They'll also have their agenda, to put it mildly.
Yeah, one of the problems we have is that so much of the water of the South Yuba passes through Nevada County, but either gets diverted from those reservoirs to Placer County or goes to Yuba County, which has its own designs.
Right. So it's there'll be plenty of publicity about the hearings as they come up, but get involved.
Can you speculate on what the real wild and scenic Yuba or South Yuba looked like before Spalding?
Well, it carried much more water. I think the well, there are like two things here. I mean, the major impact to me has been hydraulic mining, but it was much healthier system, obviously, with more water in it. But down below, when you get down to Alpha and Omega and those dams, you're beginning to get into the hydraulic mining. All that siltation, the way we see the river we see now looks very different than it did originally. It was very much more a V-shaped stream, the classic V-shaped stream with grassy bars on the edge of it. Every bit of that has been torn up by early mining, and then hydraulic mining deposited layers and layers of gravel on top of that. So despite that stopping at about 1884, we're still dealing with it.
You mentioned that the shape of the rocks that are there is very different from what they would have been 150 years ago.
It's very interesting. I mean, the rocks that we love when we go down to the Yuba, the ones that are very smooth, the ones you like to lie on and feel like a lizard, and it's all very relaxing. Well, those rocks were originally much more angular. It's the slurry from hydraulic mining that's basically tumbled those rocks around and smoothed them off. The slurry being a mixture of water and gravel and mud, and it's polished those rocks. So that's part of the legacy of hydraulic mining.
So in a way, I'm one of those people who does take a guilty pleasure in the moonscapes of hydraulic mining sites.
We might as well enjoy them.
Yeah, and I love those round rocks.
Yeah, they're beautiful.
The other big change besides the wild and scenic status farther north is the farther south, the concern about trying to revive the salmon runs.
Yeah. When the indigenous people were here, there were two runs, a fall and a spring run of salmon, steelhead, and they also, they also ate lamprey eel that came in from the ocean. But with Engelbreit, that stopped that.
But Engelbreit was originally intended as sort of as an environmental measure to keep the silt from going downstream.
Yeah, this was, Engelbreit was a dam that was really, the interest in hydraulic mining had really waned. I mean, granted, and it will go on for a long time. We still get erosion, and we still get accumulation of gravel built up. But Engelbreit was, when you get right down to it, a kind of boondoggle. There were only two or three permits that I know of for hydraulic mines after. It was built as a debris dam, but it really wasn't used.
So the idea was that if there had been hydraulic dam mining upstream, it would keep the silt from going down into the valley.
Well, the problem with this, and I know of a few on the North Yuba, it's smaller, and you can see exactly what happens, is eventually it fills up behind the dam, and you need to build others. They wanted to also build one down below North Bloomfield, and they were predicting in doing that in the 1920s that they would need another one at Jones Bar in 20 years, and et cetera. So you'd eventually have the water and the Yuba just kind of stepping.
Now, there was talk 8 or 10 years ago about possibly taking Engelbreit down, and it became essentially a political third rail.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of those things that very quickly anyone who was running for office in Nevada County realized they had to, one of the vows they had to make was, we will preserve Engelbreit. Is that still the case?
Yeah, it is. Yuba County Water Agency, you're talking about a whole county's dreams. And there's a certain amount of recreation as well on Engelbreit, but if we can, I think it'd be far more beneficial to have the salmon. I really do, because eventually Engelbreit's going to fill up too.
And you have a different kind of river farther down that's just as suitable for boating.
That's right.
I mean, once you get beyond Engelbreit, the river really widens, and there's a lot of places you can go on powerboats.
Mm-hmm. Well, you'll notice as you go get below Engelbreit, where you cross the Yuba River at Parks Bar on Highway 20, that's the new look of the river after hydraulic mining, all that gravel piled up there. So it's a legacy that we'll deal with for a long, long time until, now that our winters appear to be getting less severe, it's going to take even more time to transport all that downstream.
We've been talking about a lot about the politics and the future of the South Yuba. Let's get back to the river itself. Do you have a favorite place there? It looks like you have dozens of them.
I have many favorite places. In the winter, generally speaking, I like to get up in the where the lakes are, and I really enjoy the lower elevations in the winter. Again, I'll come back to this winter thing. I think it's something that people don't do enough of, is walking on these trails in the winter, because it's really exhilarating. You feel the heat when you're walking in the canyon in the summer. It's just an entirely different experience in the winter. But favorites, I think my overall favorite would have to be Grouse Ridge, because it's the largest area that you can walk around in, and a lot of it, for most of us, is unexplored.
Right, you could go there 20 times and find a completely different set of lakes.
I've done exactly that.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I've been talking with historian, archaeologist, photographer, and other hats, Hank Meals, about his new book, The River, Hiking Trails and History of the South Fork of the Yuba River. I'll be back in a few minutes with another local historian, Orville Bronson. His second book of local history launched into eternity, Lynchings and Judicial Executions in 19th Century Nevada County. And then I hope that maybe we can get the two of them to chat a bit about some of the things, places their books overlap, and how they see Nevada County history. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I've been talking with Hank Meals about his new book, The River. And I forgot that the reason I asked him to come on today was because he's got a book signing coming up.
Bookseller, Saturday the 14th, 1 o'clock, when most of you will be out hiking.
He hopes. And I also have with us in the studio Orville Bronson, historian of several topics in Nevada County. His very first book was about the stage adaptations of John Steinbeck, which doesn't really fit with this area, but he's the author of the Nevada County Historical Society's publication, Nevada City, which is a just under 100-page history of Nevada City. He's now come out with a new book, Launched into Eternity, Lynchings and Judicial Executions in 19th Century Nevada County. And his book signings have already happened. That wasn't very thoughtful of you.
Sorry, Eric.
Actually, I hope he had one Friday evening and one on Saturday in Nevada City, but I'm hoping he will have others coming up, and as soon as we know about them, I'll be glad to let you know, and probably also mention them on the Booktown blog. And I'll probably tell you that if you ever hear anything on this program, you want to know more about the authors or the books, you can go either to kvmr.org and click on the Booktown link under the program schedule, or go to booktown.blogspot.com, and there'll be many, many links to the authors, their books, and relevant information. So, Orville, why did you decide to write about lynchings and executions in Nevada County?
Eric, there has been quite a bit of material on crime, but it's quite scattered and appears in numerous places. I decided it might be good to add to the canon of local history by bringing everything together, at least with regard to capital punishment, under one title.
And this is about as comprehensive as you can get. Between 1858-1 and 1884, 13 men were executed in Nevada County. Of the 13, 6 were hanged by vigilantes, and 7 were hanged after judicial trials. 3 others in jail awaiting execution escaped hanging, 2 by suicide, 1 by state Supreme Court intervention. And that's it. After 1884, what happened?
There were no more executions in Nevada County until 1891, when the state took over executions from the counties.
So I'm actually surprised that in this 33-year period, there were really only 13 executions. We always think of the Gold Rush era as having been so violent.
Well, of course, the executions weren't the only thing that happened. There were banishments, ear croppings, whippings, and brandings that also occurred that basically did not result in death. Nevada County also does not appear to be any different than the other northern mine counties, particularly Placer and El Dorado.
So actually, a lot of the things we hear about are probably exaggerated. For instance, there is one hold up of a stagecoach and some bullion being seized from that, but that's only one.
Well, and that also resulted in a murder.
Right. Excuse me, but that's the only one that resulted in a murder. And in the movies, there's usually 3 or 4 people who were shot in every holdup.
Correct.
So you've decided, even though you're going to be so comprehensive and you include listings of all the judges, the district court judges, the superior court judges, the district attorneys, the sheriffs, and so on, in some ways it's about as matter-of-fact an account as you can get. There's no opinions, just straight descriptions of each one of the cases.
I'm not sure that I had an opinion. I have basically been somewhat pro-death penalty because of my law enforcement background. After doing this book, I've softened up quite a bit on the issue. My main objection to the death penalty in contemporary times is the amount of time between the sentence and the execution of the sentence. During the Gold Rush, sentences were often within a matter of hours or at least days from the conviction.
But it is true that the majority of people who are quoted here proclaimed their innocence right on the gallows.
They did, and I'm not quite sure why.
Whether it was just something, whether they really were innocent or if they just felt it would look better.
Well, clearly none of them appeared totally innocent, but in going through these crimes, certainly the majority of them would not have been executed had the crimes been committed in modern times. There would have probably been some self-defense, maybe some manslaughter, but very few capital cases, I believe.
You mentioned your law enforcement background. You have been a police officer, a probation officer, and then for the last 30-some years, a lawyer.
Former lawyer, former probation officer, and former police officer.
And contemporary author.
And contemporary author. But did your police experience, is that one of the things that drew you toward this topic?
Not particularly. No, I didn't have any particular interest in executions. It was an area that I could deal with that wasn't too large and hadn't been done before.
So essentially you see yourself, as I think you said, adding to the canon.
I'm hoping to, yes.
There's one of these cases, actually the first one you mentioned that took place, well, in Bridgeport. James Knowlton is one that Hank Mills also discusses in The River in his section on Bridgeport. For you, it's first because it's the first historically and because it was a lynching, and I guess it's one of the more questionable ones. The people who carried out the execution had strong reservations about whether Mr. Knowlton or Knowles or whatever his name was really guilty, but they wanted to make an example, and they said that he had supposedly confessed to other crimes of a revolting nature.
I felt that he was hanged on spec, pretty much. That did happen quite a bit.
And they wanted to make an example, and they thought he was bad enough that they might as well use him?
Right.
You know, at the time, county government, it was just within a few months prior to the establishment of Nevada County. So we were part of Yuba County. So with the county seat in Marysville, a lot of things got by. And so they felt strongly about making an example that would resonate. There were thousands of people there, right?
Allegedly, yes. Also, I think it's problematic getting somebody from here to Marysville and back. It wasn't an easy journey.
Yeah, that's true.
And the miscreants could be freed by their friends.
Yeah.
There was basically no jail in Nevada City. Of course, Marysville had a jail, and there was apparently a city jail in a converted building somewhere on Broad Street that couldn't hold anybody.
And it seems that the first executions were quite often just literally a rope thrown over a sturdy branch.
A branch, a beam of a building, anything that was handy. And these first lynchings kind of ranged from mob violence almost to close to vigilanteism. The miners' courts, as they were called, amounted to getting together a bunch of miners and electing a president who was called Judge Lynch, and sometimes even assigning a prosecutor and a defense attorney. But it's my opinion that if you were taken before a miners' court, that was tantamount to being found guilty.
When did the formal judicial system take over?
Well, it was in place in 1851, but it either took quite a while for it to filter down to these miners, or they ignored it. There were judges back at that time, but they didn't wield much power, as near as I can tell.
And at that time, executions were still public spectacles.
Until 1858, when the legislature made them private, basically at the behest of the abolitionists.
Why the abolitionists?
They didn't want executions at all.
Oh, okay.
Mitigation.
Yes. Yeah. And then at a certain point, as you say, in 1884, they were all moved out of the county.
1884 was the last execution in Nevada County. 91 was when the state took them over, allegedly because a lot of the county sheriffs were bungling the executions. I did not find any evidence that any of them were mishandled in Nevada County.
Speaking of evidence, basically it comes from newspapers, but you've also gone through court records?
A little, but mainly newspapers. They're not a primary resource, but basically all we have in the absence of journals or letters. Also supplemented it with historical society articles and a couple of books, one on Major Downey, one on Stephen Field, and Fremont Older, the editor of The Call in San Francisco, who was a prisoner advocate.
Right, and you even mentioned that one of the people who pretty definitely was guilty of what he was accused of, but escaped essentially because of some technicalities. The jury was hung. He wound up in the custody of Fremont Alder.
Right, and it really wasn't a technicality, as the lone holdout for the death penalty had served in the Confederate Army with the defendant, Collins, and most probably served in Quantrill's Raiders with him also.
So he just refused to
absolutely
vote for
refused.
The death penalty. And but the fact that this fellow Thorne, who seemed probably about, if any of these people were demonstrably wicked, he was, but he seemed to have reformed by the end of his life.
Well, after 50 or 60 years, you know, one might guess that there was a change.
You're going to move on from this to another kind of crime history?
Well, I have under construction cases of homicide in Nevada County that did not result necessarily in a conviction, and certainly not the death penalty.
Now, Hank, in your book, you as I said, you put in the same story about Knowles or Knowlton. Why did you think it was important in Bridgeport or in South Yuba history?
Well, I think it was pretty representative. Well, first of all, it happened at Bridgeport, and I was writing about Bridgeport right there. But I think it was pretty representative of the mood. I think it addresses a mood that was around. There were some psychopaths around, and people had to be dealt with. And I also enjoyed, I used three of the classic Nevada County histories, Brown and Dallas and the 1867 Bean, and then Wells one in 1880, and they all handled it a little differently, even though the 1880 one generally rewrites what was in the 1867 one. But they all kind of had the same mood that he may or may not have been the guy. I love that casual approach, being this far distant from it, but we're going to make an example of him.
Now, when you write your book, which is a history and a guide, you are very opinionated. Orville, you do not have any opinions whatsoever.
I have opinions, Eric. I didn't think it was necessarily appropriate on the kind of book I did, no offense to Hank, I did a little bit of editorializing, but it wasn't my own. It was material that appeared in the newspapers so that there'd be some flavor of what the community was feeling. But I didn't think it was, I wasn't looking for a bully pulpit.
But some of these newspaper articles and editorials were actually quite abashed by the lynchings that had occurred, and even by some of the judicial executions.
They were. And also at the end of the book, there appears a pretty lengthy piece on capital punishment that's very much in favor of it.
From the Daily Transcript.
From the Transcript.
1878. How much time did you spend reading newspapers?
Oh, about 18 months. Every page of every newspaper from 1850 to 1900.
So you went at this project knowing that this was what you wanted to research, and you went through them with these particular cases in mind.
Well, I did, but I also collected other material, you know, always thinking ahead a little bit. So I also got the non-capital cases at the same time.
Right, which you're going to use in the future.
Right.
Whereas, Hank, I get the impression that your history is just stuff you've picked up over the years. Or did you do specific research?
I did a lot of detailed research. We've run into each other in the library all the time. But it's interesting you should bring up the thing about opinion, because this is the last history book I'm going to write, and I've been writing for many years very sort of bulletproof reports that are done according to the strict canons of archaeology and history. And I figured this is time to air it out. I do have opinions. And so I lay out the historic facts and give my interpretation.
Orville, is there ever going to be a time when you're going to write opinionated history, or do you think it's just your job to collect the record?
I'll probably collect the record only because I am vehemently opposed to judging are applying contemporary standards to historic events.
And you're a little less so, Hank.
Well, an example, I know exactly what Orville's talking about. Say, the Sawyer decision, 1884, most people talk about it as environmental legislation, which it wasn't at all, and that's a perspective from here. It was really two competing industries, agriculture and and that's something I took advantage of the book to clear up a little bit, because I knew I'd have a good readership, and we might as well get this straight.
And the agricultural interests actually had the backing
of the railroad, yeah.
Which was not so powerful in Nevada County, but was every place else in the state.
Yeah, it was a big deal, really. So they had their newspapers. I mean, we're tending to view it as a small farmer, but we're really talking about agribusinesses, where the interests of the valley, they were large landowners.
You say this is going to be your last history. Do you have other books in mind?
Well, I'm going to do some photographs for my wife's cookbook coming up. Ooh. That's the only thing I have planned.
What kind of cookbook?
Oh, it'll be it's a Whole Foods cookbook, but it's coming from a kind of a philosophy of enjoying food, con mucho gusto.
Aha. Orville, your wife's right behind you. Is she working on anything?
Well, she's my muse, my business manager, my marketing director, and...
That's enough to ask of anyone?
That's pretty much enough, yes.
Do you have anything in mind after you've finished off Nevada County Crime, or is this something you can just sort of see one project and when you're done with it, you move on to the next?
I have basically completed what I had hoped to be a book, which will not be a book, on a California and Nevada pioneer by the name of Henry DeGroot. I question the interest or the markability of this, but this was a very important man back during the Gold Rush. He wrote extensively about mining. He laid out Virginia City. He named Lake Tahoe. He was one of the very first to write on the Donner Party. He was a newspaperman, doctor, lawyer, cartographer. I hope to do something with it, although it probably won't end up being a book.
He wrote my favorite mining glossary.
As a book or?
No, just as a part of a state mineralogist report publication.
Yes. I have probably assembled the most complete bibliography on him, on his works, and also the most complete biography by way of his Union College records in Schenectady and the Society of Pioneers material. It's very important, but what'll come of it, who knows?
So it might just be a historical society.
I think it's more than that, but I'm not quite sure what. I'm kind of in contact with Gary Kuritz, who's the principal librarian at the state, and we'll see what he has to say. I'm interested in his input on this.
Something just went crash in the other room, but we're going to ignore it. Any thoughts on, well, let's see, you've been doing this for 30 years, Hank. Orville, you're a piker. You've just been doing it for 7 or 8.
Well, not exactly. I mean, I've been writing sentencing recommendations for the Superior Court for a good deal longer than that.
But things that you've put out between covers.
Yes, I'm afraid I'm a rookie.
Well, I'm just faking it myself.
Is Nevada County history something you think has importance for people outside of this area?
I definitely believe it does. People come here from all over for various and sundry reasons. Either they have relatives or ancestors that were here, or they come for the mining, or they come for the railroad. Many reasons why people come here. I think it is the Nevada City in particular is the queen city of the northern mines, and I'll have to include the county in that, I guess.
Well, you know, and it's in the 1880s, 70s, and 80s in particular, it was the technological, it was the Silicon Valley, whatever, of the world. The innovations were happening here. When it came to water management, moving water between watersheds, there was a phenomenal amount of innovative activity here. It's interesting, when I was working on the chapter on Malakoff, I'd run into tourists from France and Japan and Germany were absolutely fascinated with Nevada County history. And that so much of it's mechanical, you can see it. It's not like an electronic universe like computers.
Although it's very funny, all of this is running together in my mind. I think I was actually looking for one of Dave Comstock's books online recently, and this was at the same time I was reading both of your books, and I ran across a page, I think it was Wikipedia page on Nevada County, and at the very bottom it lists all the technological innovations in Nevada County, and they tend to be in two groups, and one of them is all in the 1870s to 1890s, and the other is from 1940 to the present, and they're mostly high tech, and they're ones that we might not have known. I'm trying to remember certain things, like I think it said that the first video game was actually developed here.
Oh, really?
Although not marketed here, and a number of things of that sort that you wouldn't have expected.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess we're keeping up our role in the world.
It remains a dynamic place.
Yeah. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and for the last hour I've been talking with two Nevada County historians about their most recent books. Hank Meals, The River, Hiking Trails and History of the South Fork of the Yuba River. He's going to be having a book signing this coming Saturday at the bookseller at
1 o'clock.
1 o'clock. So that's the day before Father's Day, and that's the bike race weekend. So if you want a reason to get out of Nevada City, go to the bookseller in Grass Valley. And as I said, Orville Bronson had his book, already scheduled book signings have already occurred for his book Launched into Eternity, Lynchings and Judicial Executions in 19th Century Nevada County. But I hope he'll schedule more in the future. And if he does, I'll be glad to let you know. So as I say, this has been Booktown. We are out of time. Jimmy Accardi has 2 hours coming up, so let's wait for him.